Timo Bolt is the co-founder and CEO of technology-cum-food business Gusto, which is one of the UK's leading meal kit providers. Essentially, it helps busy people cook at home by delivering recipe boxes full of fresh ingredients direct to their door. Since its launch in 2012, Gusto has delivered over 13 million meals to customers across the UK, and reckons it has saved nearly a million kilograms of food wastage too. Off the back of strong growth, in March this year, the venture secured a further £28.5 million in funding to expand its reach and improve its technology. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Matt Alagaya. Today, Timo is here to explain how he's managed to scale Gusto and how he hopes to tap into a recipe box market that's expected to be worth £500 million by 2020.
Before starting Gusto, I lived in the US in California. I've got family who have worked in the food trade all of their life. You know, they've over 50 years, they've built an organic supermarket, a vineyard, all small businesses, never raised money, no boards. But when I lived in the US, I worked in one of their supermarkets. So I had a massive passion for food, which kind of came from my family in California. I then stumbled upon finance, as one did back in 2007, pre-financial crisis. I don't think that's the case anymore. But back then, it was quite popular to go into finance. I like math. I like numbers. You know, I'm a geek to some extent. So I thought, why not give it a try? I did an internship in New York and Frankfurt. They then told me, why not go to London? You know, we've got a job for you. So 2 days later, I flew to London and had a job in investment banking.
How long were you there? And I guess, why did you then decide to leave that profession and become an entrepreneur?
I spent 2.5 years in investment banking, and I then joined a hedge fund focused on, you know, trading equities. During that time, I gained a little toolbox, an analytical toolbox. But I think the biggest learning for me was that there's absolutely no focus on culture, people, vision, strategy, all the stuff that really matters. So I think my biggest learning was, this is how you shouldn't do it, right? People are amazing and you should really focus on their potential. So combining the two, and then with my passion for food and my kind of love for entrepreneurship, I thought of setting up a company that solves problems and really, really empowers people.
When you say you didn't like the kind of the culture or the, I think, yeah, you used the atmosphere, that kind of thing at the hedge fund. Just explain what it was like. I mean, was it very high pressured, or what was the feeling there that you didn't like?
Don't get me wrong. Like, I really enjoyed my time and I met amazing people and I learned a tremendous amount. But ultimately, I want to do good in life and I want to have fun and I want to meet people I really enjoy working with and I want to learn and develop, right? Those are kind of my personal values. And I feel like, or I felt back then, that the financial industry, at least the way I experienced it, was too focused on, you know, financial objectives, trading, and so on. And it just wasn't for me, but it might be for other people. So I'm still in touch with all the people. The chair from Rothschild, the investment bank I worked at, is invested into Gusto. I'm still friends. We hired a few people from banking, but I'm very, very excited. You know, I do what I do today.
We've moved on seamlessly now to Gusto. Tell us a little bit about what the company does for anyone who doesn't know the company already.
Gusto is on a mission to make your life easier, better, and more healthy. So you choose whatever you like to eat, and we send you the exact ingredients and the exact portions. So you still cook, but we make your life easier, better, and more healthy. We have a menu of 30 meals to choose from on a weekly basis. We deliver 7 days a week across all of the UK. Meals start from £2.89, including free delivery. So it's ridiculously good value for what you pay. And that's our mission. I'm sure you are competitively busy. I'm competitively busy. We're all hugely busy. So we're trying to help families that just don't have the time but really want a healthy, you know, diet.
That's a great elevator pitch there. I like it. So you set up the company in 2012, but did you have the idea way before that? When did the idea kind of germinate in you, I guess?
I have 100 ideas per day, so I had plenty of ideas back then, but I felt very strongly that I wanted to do something that has positive impact on people. and that I want to work in food because I love to eat, as you can tell. I wanted to solve my own problem. So whenever I did find the time to cook, I ended up wasting tons of food and the quality wasn't there. Screening recipe books takes hours and then the recipe takes 60 minutes despite the guy telling you it's 15 minutes. So I kind of felt like, you know, putting this all into a box, shaking it, Gusto is kind of what came out. That's where the idea came from.
Were there other businesses around that you got your inspiration from? Did you get the idea from somewhere else and think, okay, I could kind of bring this into the UK and the European market? Or was it just kind of the thing that popped into your head?
I was completely naive back then. No one did this in the world in 2012. Today, the world has moved on and there are a number of companies. But back then, this was blue ocean. So I had to convince people that this could be a business model that actually works. And it makes sense for you to buy your ingredients in a box. No one did this back then. But obviously, I got a ton of inspiration from food brands I like, from entrepreneurs I love watching, and so on.
Any examples of people or businesses or business models that kind of really excited you back then when you were kind of coming up with the idea for Gusto?
What really excited me is looking at the world and seeing that the biggest trends in grocery land in the world are sustainability, health, convenience, and online. And Gusto is ticking all those four boxes. So when you take sustainability, as a company, supermarkets are wasting 20% of food. As a consumer, we're wasting 20% of food. So there's 40% of food wasted in the world, which is hugely painful because not everyone has enough food. Point one, point two, you know, this population is going from 8 billion to 10 billion, so we need 70% more food. So I really, 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 really focused on how can I find a business model that reduces food waste, both at household level and supermarket level, combine the two, and then create win-win-win-win, you know, environment, customer, business model, and so on. So this was kind of the initial focus. I spent quite a lot of time at trying to come up with an idea that would allow us to do that.
Let's focus for a second on sustainability, because I definitely agree with you that the food wastage is a huge problem with supermarkets and the way that they're run. But I guess one thing that now we're becoming aware of, and definitely seems like in the past kind of 6 months has become a big topic, is, you know, we've seen Iceland, for instance, in this country, have a packaging-free aisle, or at least, you know, they've planned to have a packaging-free aisle at some point. Packaging is becoming a hugely kind of contentious issue. I mean, because I know that, you know, sometimes in the box there'll be tiny packets of paprika and there's only one serving in there. Is there a way of doing that without having quite so much, you know, small packaging, I guess?
I can't tell you enough how excited I am that the public is, pushing supermarkets to focus on packaging. Overnight success takes 10 years. We've solved food waste as one of the few companies in grocery land. Obviously, we need to reduce our packaging waste. I'm extremely proud that the team has achieved 88% recyclability on plastic, which is far higher than any supermarket in the world. But there's so much more we want to do. Can we come up with a solution that has zero waste? Can we return boxes? Can we put an RFID chip into a box and then, you know, see where the box is and return it? Kind of Internet of Things on steroids. So there are lots and lots of ideas, but I'm absolutely certain that it's not sustainable. If you shove food across 10,000 supermarkets in the country, you will incur huge, huge, huge waste, both on packaging and food. So therefore, yes, we've come a long way on food waste. Now we're improving our packaging, maybe even to zero. Let's see.
And you must feel, as a European, as a German, I guess the level here is quite a lot lower than in Germany. I mean, in Germany, you have Pfand on each plastic bottle and they get recycled almost, 99% of them get recycled. Here, we're a bit slow off the mark. So I guess there is an opportunity in that sense as well.
Yeah, I think there's a massive opportunity and every single business has a huge responsibility to play, having impact on the environment and the way we live. So we're taking this incredibly seriously. It's right at the core of our mission.
One thing I'm fascinated by when it comes to your business is the kind of logistics, the backroom stuff that must have to go on, because you're now sending out hundreds of thousands of meals every month. Just talk us through what that actually entails. I mean, I'm guessing that a lot of your customers, at least in this country, you know, they're there within the M25, but how do you still get them to everyone around the country?
So the vast majority of our customers are scattered across the UK, living outside of Leeds or Manchester, but everywhere across the UK. We deliver 7 days a week. We have the shortest lead time out of all the companies in our space. But as you rightfully pointed out, this is a huge challenge. We are a data company that happens to trade in food. What I mean by this is we have managed to apply AI in a very narrow way to solve forecasting, automation, supply chain challenges that other companies haven't solved yet. So, for example, we achieved 0.16% food waste in March in the factory. Massive credit to the team, to a couple of teams. But at the heart of this is the ability to forecast more accurately than anyone else in the world. So we're applying data science, technology to come up with those solutions. But then at the same time, we have managed to build a platform. So our factory is automated. You see a lot of clever stuff in the factory going on to make absolutely sure that you get all the ingredients in perfect quality. There's no food waste.
And did you have to bring in people with that knowledge? I'm guessing, I mean, you come from a finance background. So did you have the skills with technology and AI and that kind of thing? Or did you have to bring that in?
It's all about empowering people. I'm clueless, but I'm very fortunate to work with people who can figure stuff out. I listen and I deeply care and then I empower people. That's, you know, my main job description. I'm also blessed to have a wonderful wife who has a PhD and postdoc in neuroscience. So in the early days, she pushed me to think about this stuff more from a data and technology point of view. So in year one, we hired our first PhD in machine learning. We now have a large team of really, really clever people. And they have, you know, gotten us up the learning curve over the last couple of years. And we're now starting to see compounding benefits from it.
It strikes me that your business has a level of sort of variety within it that must be very unusual. I mean, you have people who are PhDs in neuroscience and AI. And at the same time, you also need chefs and people who are incredibly creative creating these recipes. Do you have to be kind of across all of that yourself? I mean, do you spend some of your days in the kitchen with the chefs kind of tasting things? And do you then go to the lab and talk to the AI scientists?
So 6 years ago, I was completely naive in the sense I was optimistic. I thought I found a way to reduce food waste and delight customers across the UK. Turns out this is by far the most complex, you know, model you can ever stumble upon. 6 years later, yes, we have a highly diverse team. We employ, as you said, PhDs in machine learning, but then we obviously run a factory where we have an amazing team of more than 200 people working to make sure that customers get exactly what they want. So therefore, my job is pretty much to focus on culture, punch above our weight when it comes to hiring, make sure people feel recognized in whatever position they play, whether they pick boxes or they cook recipes. I massively appreciate what they do for the company. I see them as owners. 161 people in our company are shareholders in Gusto. So we're trying to instill this ownership thinking and very blessed to work with those guys.
And on the creative side, when we do talk about, you know, creating new recipes, I mean, you produce, I think, 20 recipes every week, or at least that's what customers can choose from. Just talk us through, you know, how that process works. I mean, are you literally tasting things before they're put on your menu on your website?
So you will be delighted to hear that I no longer am a test chef. I used to develop recipes myself. I think they all got banned for various reasons. I'm pretty sure it's operational, not customer feedback, but yeah. So we have a team of chefs that, you know, who cook every single day from the morning to the evening. They come up with amazing ideas. Some people want healthy meals, so we have people dedicated, nutritionists dedicated to coming up with amazingly healthy nutritionist food. But then at the same time, we have people focusing on families. They spend time in family homes to observe how do families actually behave. My son is 4 months old. Your son might be 15 years, right? And they eat completely differently. So we're investing hugely into understanding how people eat. How do we make their lives easier? It's all about the customer and real customer obsession.
That's kind of something I wanted to touch on, because I guess we've just brought out our first food and drink magazine at Monocle, Drinking and Dining. And it's interesting how quickly that space is moving now. I mean, I think, you know, it's always been relatively rapid, but it seems now that, you know, there's a new food trend every week and there's a new ingredient that everyone's talking about. Do you have to be really aware? Do you have to read the literature? Do you have to watch the TV shows? Do you have to be reading blogs to find out what trends might be emerging in one part of the world and then coming here next? Do you feel like you have to really be on top of what's happening in food and drink in that world?
10 years ago, I went to a couple of restaurants that really inspired me. Today, I take it for granted that wherever I go, I expect inspiration. I'm no longer eating a burger, I'm eating, you know, a Korean barbecue burger. So I think the level of sophistication has risen massively in the last 10 years, and we are obsessing about food trends and how do we incorporate those into the menu. We offer 30 meals on a weekly basis, more choice than anyone in this market, and so therefore we're giving customers as much novelty as possible. But what's really important is, if you think about innovation and you just break it down into ideation, so coming up with ideas, selection, you know, what do we actually do? And then execution, we kind of outsourced ideation to the customer. So what I mean by that is we listen to customers. We deeply, deeply, deeply care what they tell us on social media. So we're aware of food trends much, much faster. The selection and the execution is then more or less automated and done by AI and machine learning and technology. So the cycle of innovation is hugely fast. Within 3 to 4 weeks, you know, we have an amazing idea. We give it to you as a customer across all of the UK, making it possible. If you contrast this to kind of the old way of retailing, you know, where it takes a quarter and then Tesco gives you a call, hey, blue yogurt isn't selling, let's try red yogurt. And it takes another quarter to figure out, you know, whether it works or not. We've massively made this customer centric.
Just when we look at the customer, I mean, you've tapped into something for quite early on. You know, the company was founded in 2012. You tapped into this idea that people have less time and they still want healthy food, but they want it conveniently. How is the customer changing today? I mean, this is 6 years on. Are you finding that people are much more, you know, aware of provenance of food? Are they much more aware of the healthiness of food and you know, how what this ingredient's going to do for this part of their health? Do you find that that's something that's really changing in the customer today?
How many times a week do you eat dinner?
That's a tough one.
No, I'm sorry. It's a ridiculously stupid question. But the point I want to make is we all eat dinner 365 days a year. So we're very fortunate. We're operating in a world where there are 1 billion meals eaten on a weekly basis in the UK alone. So it's a huge market opportunity. That was the same 6 years ago, and it's the same in 16 years and 26 years. The only thing that changes is kind of how we consume food. For 50 years, supermarkets have, you know, built stores across the UK. In the next 50 years, my son, your son, families, you know, will order on the go, watching their kids, being in a bus, and so on. So convenience, health, sustainability, online, all of this is on the rise. People are absolutely more aware of sustainability topics, which is amazing. People care deeply about provenance. They care about where their food is from. And they care about, you know, CO2 emissions and having an impact, a positive impact, which is fantastic for us. We're ticking all those boxes. We're riding a massive, massive wave. And supermarket can't compete and give customers what they actually want. So the world has completely changed. Trust has changed. People trust small brands that deeply care and are honest and focus on provenance and sustainability.
That's interesting. I think the only food trend you need to be worried about is the fasting trend. If people stop eating altogether, that's the one you need to be a little bit scared of. Let's talk a little bit about how you've grown the company, because I guess this is one of those... It's one of those businesses that you need to have scale for it to really work. And I know that you've taken on investment, I think, a few rounds. Just talk us through how you've taken on investment and what you've used that to do and, how you've grown the company effectively over the past 6 years.
I have conviction that this is a massive, massive market opportunity. We're seeing a huge shift in the way people behave and eat. So if you take the 10-year horizon, and you look at the food trends, it's completely clear that if you want to build an amazing, amazing product for customers to love and have every single week, you really got to obsess about building capabilities, tech, automation platform, AI, and so on. So we've taken a very long time horizon. I'm very fortunate. I'm very privileged. It's day two. All we've done so far is we're scratching the surface. You see the tip of the iceberg. We're taking a very long-term view here. And we've gained the right to play in this huge shift in consumer behavior. So that's always been our approach. Therefore, we've taken on nearly $100 million in capital from investors to obsess about the customer and to make your life as easy, simple, you know, good and healthy as possible, and to really, really differentiate and to build a moat around the castle, making this proposition stand out and defendable.
you said when you set up the company, no one else was doing anything like this. We've now seen, over the past couple of years, a few more players come into this space. How do you differentiate your brand from those other ones? I mean, it's one of those things that I always find really interesting. I mean, if you have a physical space somewhere, you can make your brand come alive for someone. But if you're on an app, you know, it's quite difficult to differentiate the product and give your customer a kind of different brand experience. So what are the ways in which you think, okay, this is how we're going to differentiate ourselves from our competitors?
We take a very long time horizon. We obsess about the customer, and then we empower the very best people in the world to work on those tough problems. And if you break this down, first of all, we see huge short-term focus in the world. We're taking the long-term horizon. We deeply understand how customers think and how they behave. And all we care about is making it better and better and better and better for you as a customer. So I think that's a huge, huge differentiation and strategy that manifests itself in product differentiation. So we are offering 30 meals on a weekly basis. No one else is doing this. The closest competitor in the world is doing 10 meals. So it's a huge, huge choice. Whatever you like, healthy, family-friendly, spicy, esoteric, whatever you like, right? We'll have it. We also offer by far the lowest price point for the best quality. We're less expensive by 25%. Meals are from $2.89, including free delivery, which is ridiculously good value for money and really, really mass market. And then we offer the most convenient service, 7-day delivery, shortest lead time, 10-minute meals, truly 10-minute meals, which no one else is offering. So complete customer obsession, product obsession, complete differentiation on product. And then we obsess about culture and really empower people, hiring the very best people and the most passionate people, who are also really nice and friendly people at the same time, and really empowering them to do amazing things. And that's the secret sauce. I think if you focus on selling the business in 2 years, you will take massive shortcuts on your product, on your employees, because you simply don't care. Overnight success takes 10 years. So we really, really, really obsess about this stuff.
You've mentioned a couple of times, one of the things it sounds like you're very proud of is the corporate culture that you've created. Have you got any tips for people wanting to build a kind of a culture that is inclusive and inspiring, and people are feel empowered to be creative? Are there any tips you can give our listeners for making that happen?
Whilst, of course, it's important to hire intelligent and smart and driven people, at the end of the day, it comes down to, do you want to hang out with those people or not, right? Like, are they the types of people you have chemistry with? Because, yes, you will work long hours and you will push hard and, you know, there will be challenges. So it all comes down to finding amazing people and then empowering them. It's all about ownership, not accountability. If I have to come to your desk every single day saying, have you done this? Have you done this? You'll most likely leave at some point. But if I can make you feel ridiculously proud of the role you play, you know, and the success you create for the entire company and organization, and you feel special on a daily basis, you feel truly empowered, and you're most likely working harder than if I was to tell you to work harder. So I think culture is sometimes this weird kind of academic construct, but it actually just comes down to people caring about people, taking an interest and understanding what motivates them, and then really, really kind of giving them, you know, career progression, stretching them, giving them learning and development, and kind of taking them on a journey.
And for you personally, how have you developed as a manager? Because, you know, you started out in 2012 with a handful of people, and you now have 200 plus employees. Has it been difficult for you to let some things go, or has it been very easy to rise above it and just manage things and delegate, I guess?
So in 5 years, Gusto has gone from one employee in my living room to now close to 400 employees and going north of 500 by end of this year. We just hired 58 people in April. So my role has completely changed. For 4 years, I've been an entrepreneur coming up with crazy ideas and running through the wall to make things happen. And then chapter two I'm currently on is being a CEO who empowers people, builds a leadership team, truly empowers them, stops micromanaging. The jury is still out. You know, I'm tremendously enjoying my job and I really love what I do. But my career has changed, and it is really all about, can you find scalable people? Do they truly own their team and their function? Can you delegate? how much do you empower them? It sounds quite basic, but this is really, really core. And building high-performance teams looks ridiculously glamorous on the outside. Everyone wants to be on a winning team, but being on the inside is really, really, really hard work. Getting highly diverse people to think in the same way and to care about the same stuff and to have collective goals and to have collective purpose and to make sure that if they maximize their objectives, they understand the impact they have on other functions, and creating room for analytical people on the one hand, but on the other side, creative people, is all really, really hard. So it requires a lot of thinking. It requires a lot of purposeful action and kind of, you know, organizational design thinking. And then it all comes down to people.
Have you taken inspiration from some of the people you worked with at the investment bank or at the hedge fund? Do you read management books yourself? I mean, are you someone who's obsesses about management? Where do you get your ideas from?
I think I'm a decent, maybe mediocre manager. I think I'm a fairly good leader. There's a big difference between the two. And my philosophy is, you know, setting realistic goals is the most commonly traveled road to mediocrity. And what I want to say is, right, set huge stretch goals, take everyone with you, galvanize everyone, make sure everyone gets it and they see the plan and they understand what they're shooting for. They have a North Star, they get really, really pumped up and excited, and then understand, and you know, their motivations, give them learning and development, do everything you can to empower them to reach the North Star. But that's all it comes down to. I think there are a couple of amazing people who get this really right in the world, and I learn a lot from them. I have done an executive MBA in Cambridge, so I do have a basic understanding of management. I also work with various coaches. I've got roughly 20 mentors. I consult on various topics, so I'm a constant learnerholic. I get huge energy from talking to people. I call up, you know, 10 people every single day to consult them on issues. Big believer in continuous learning and development and redefining yourself every single year. Otherwise, the company is kind of outgrowing myself, to be honest.
What are your sort of big plans for the next 12 months and then beyond that?
It all starts with the customer. What more can I do for customers or we as an organization? We constantly ask customers, we look at the data, we really, really understand what customers want, we force rank, and then we put all our energy into executing against those two or three really, really big ideas that then change customers' lives over 3 years. So we're working on really, really, really big innovation that will massively change the way people eat across the UK and really make their lives better and easier and even more healthy. So all our energy is going into the next 3 to 6 years. That's our focus. We've built AI and technology capabilities that allow us to truly give customers what they love. It's very tempting to use those capabilities and do plug and play and, you know, power different brands and go into different markets. But at the end of the day, 1 billion meals are eaten in the UK alone on a weekly basis. 70% is home cooked. That's 700 million meals. We're scratching the surface. If I can just get 1%, right, we're building a multi-billion business here. So it's all about focus. It's all about staying true to the customer and then empowering the right people to execute against those ideas. But you'll see more of the same, truly, truly, truly having impact on the way you eat over the next couple of years.
Thanks very much to Timo Bolt, founder of Gusto, for coming in and sharing his story. Thanks too to Daniel Bache, who produced this show, and to Kieran Matthew Banerjee, who edited it. I'm Matt Alagaya. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.